This is Audible.
Hawaii by James A. Michener. Introduction by Steve Barry. Read for you by Larry A. McKeever. With an introduction read by Fred Sanders.
But the two antagonists respected each other. Malama knew that the little missionary was fighting for no less than her entire soul. He would be content with no substitute, and he was an honest man whom she could trust. She also knew him to be a brave man who was willing to face any adversary, and she sensed that through her he intended to capture all of Maui. That would not be a bad thing, she thought to herself. Of all the white men who have come to Lahaina, and she recalled the whalers, the traders, the military, he is the only one who has brought more than he took away. After all, what is it he is trying to get me to do? She reflected. He wants me to stop sending the men into the forests for sandalwood. He wants me to build better fish ponds and to grow more taro. He wants me to protect the girls from the sailors and to stop baby girls from being buried alive. Everything Makuahale tells me is a good thing. Then she would pause and think of her kapu husband, Kelolo. But I will not give up Kelolo until just before I am going to die. And so the warfare between Malama and Abner continued. But if a morning passed when duties kept him from the grass palace, Malama was uneasy, for her arguments with Abner were the best part of her day. She sensed that he was telling her the truth, and he was the first man who had ever done so. When the time came for Jerusha's baby to be born, she was faced by unwelcome news from Dr. Whipple. I have been detained on Hawaii, where three mission wives are expecting babies, and it will be totally impossible for me to come to Lahaina. I am sure that Brother Abner will be able to handle the delivery capably. But nevertheless, I beg your forgiveness. I am sorry. She grew afraid. At one point, she even went so far as to suggest, perhaps we should ask one of the local women to help us. But Abner was adamant and quoted Jeremiah, thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen. And he pointed out how unlikely it was that a heathen woman, steeped in idols and vice, would know how to deliver a Christian baby, and Jerusha agreed. But this time, stubborn little Abner had so memorized Deland's midwifery, and Jerusha was finally so content to rely on him, that her boy was born without difficulty. And when Abner held the child for the first time, he rather stolidly congratulated himself on having done such a good job of doctoring. But when the time came to place the boy in Jerusha's left arm and apply the infant's mouth to his wife's breast, the floods of emotion that he had so long imprisoned within his tight heart burst loose, and he fell onto the earth beside the bed and confessed, my dearest companion, I love you more than I will ever be able to explain. I love you, Jerusha. And she, hearing these words of comfort in an alien land, the words she had so longed for, fed her child and was content. We will call the boy Micah, he announced at last. I had thought some sweeter name, perhaps David, she suggested. We will call him Micah, Abner replied. Is he strong? She asked weakly. Strong in the goodness of the Lord, Abner assured her. And within 2 weeks, she was teaching her classes again, a slim, radiant missionary woman, sweating in a heavy woolen dress. For one of the peculiarities of the missionaries was that they insisted upon living in tropical Hawaii exactly as if they were back home in bleak New England. They wore the same heavy clothing, did the same amount of tiring work, ate the same heavy meals whenever they could be obtained. In a land rich with Polynesian fruits, their greatest joy was to obtain from some passing ship a bag of dried apples, so that they could enjoy once more a thick, sweet apple pie. Wild cattle roamed the hills, but the missionaries preferred salt pork. There was an abundance of fish in the shallows, but they clung desperately to dried beef shipped out from Boston. Breadfruit they rarely touched, and coconuts were heathenish. In all his years on Maui, Abner Hale would never once do any of God's official work unless costumed in underwear, heavy woolen pants, long shirt, stock, vest, heavy clawhammer coat, and, if the meeting were outside, his big beaver hat. Jerusha dressed comparably. But what was impossible to comprehend was the fact that each year on the 1st of October, when the Hawaiian summer was hottest, mission families regularly climbed into heavy woolen underwear. They had followed this custom in Boston. They would follow it here. Nor did they ever find relief by swimming in the cool lagoon, for Bartholomew Parr's London Medical Dictionary specifically warned them, Natatio, swimming is a laborious exercise and should not be continued to exhaust the strength. It is not natural to man as to quadrupeds, for the motions of the latter in swimming are the same as in walking. All these conventions resulted in one of the most serious breaches between the Hawaiians and the missionaries. The former, who loved to bathe and who rarely did even 20 minutes' work without sluicing themselves afterwards, found the missionaries not only dirty people, but actually offensive in smell. Sometimes Malama, irritated by their sweaty odors, tried to suggest that Abner and Jerusha might like to swim on the fine kapu beach of the Ali'i. But Abner rejected the invitation as if it had come from the devil. So all the accumulated wisdom of the islanders was ignored by the mission families. Perspiring in unbelievably heavy clothing, eschewing the healthful foods that surrounded them, they stubbornly toiled and grew faint and lost their health and died. But in doing so, they converted a nation. In 1823, when the building of the church was two-thirds completed, Kailolo approached Abner one evening with his final plea. "We can still change the entrance," he argued. "Then the evil spirits will be sure to keep away." "God keeps evil from his churches," Abner replied coldly. "Will you come with me to the grounds?" Kailolo begged. "Everything has been arranged," Abner snapped. "I want to show you a simple way," Kailolo began. "No," Abner cried. "Please," the tall chief insisted. "There is something you must know." Against his better judgment, Abner threw down his pen and grudgingly walked in the night air to the church grounds, where a group of elderly men sat on their haunches, studying his church. "What are they doing?" Abner asked. "They are my praying kahunas," Kailolo explained. "No," Abner protested, drawing back. "I do not want to argue with kahunas about a church of the Lord." "These men love the Lord," Kailolo insisted. "Ask them. They know the catechism. They want the church to be built strong." "Kailolo," Abner explained patiently, drawing near to the solemn kahunas, "I understand perfectly that in the old days these kahunas accomplished much that was good, but God does not require kahunas." "Makuahale," Kailolo pleaded, "we have come to you as friends who love this church. Please do not keep the door where it is. Every kahuna knows that that is wrong for the spirits of this location." "God is the supreme spirit," Abner argued. But since the night was pleasant, with a pale crescent moon in the west and occasional clouds sweeping in from the roads, he sat with the kahunas and talked with them about religion. He was surprised at how much of the Bible they knew, and at the skill with which they could accommodate it to their ancient beliefs. One old man explained, "We believe you are correct in what you say, Makuahale. There is only one God, and we used to call him Kane. There is a Holy Ghost, and we called him Ku. There is Jesus Christ, and he is Lono. And there is the King of the Underworld, and he is Kanaloa." "God is not Kane," Abner reasoned. But the kahunas merely listened, and when it came time for them to speak, they said, "Now when Kane, that is God, wishes a church to be built, he supervises it. He always did when we built our temples. God does not personally supervise the building of this church, Abner explained. Kane did. But God is not Kane, Abner patiently repeated. The men nodded sagely and continued. Now, since Kane is concerned about this church, and since we have always loved Kane, we thought it proper to advise you that this door... The door will be where it now is, Abner explained, because that is where the door to a church has always been. In Boston, the door would be here. In London, it would be here. But in Lahaina, Kane would not like it to be here, the kahunas argued. Kane is not God, Abner stubbornly repeated. We understand, Makuahale, the kahunas politely agreed. But since God and Kane are the same idea... No, Abner insisted. God and Kane are not the same. Of course, the kahunas agreed heartily. Their names are different. But we know that Kane would not like this door here. The door has to be here, Abner explained. If it is, Kane will destroy the church, the kahuna said sorrowfully. God does not go about destroying his own churches, Abner assured the men. But we know that Kane does, if they are built wrong. And since Kane and God mean the same thing... The solemn kahunas never lost their tempers with the stubborn little stranger who did not quite understand religion, so far as they could judge, and Abner had learned not to lose his. So the argument about the door lasted for several hours, until the moon had vanished from the west, and only low, dark clouds scudded across the mysterious and silent sky. With nothing agreed, but with the kahunas feeling very sorry for their misguided friend, who insisted upon building a doomed church for Kane, the meeting broke up, and Kelolo said, After I bid the kahunas good night, I will walk back home with you. I can find my way alone, Abner assured him. On a night like this, Kelolo said speculatively, looking at the low clouds over the coconut palms, it would be better, perhaps. And he bade the kahunas a hasty farewell so that he could hurry down the dusty road and overtake the missionary. But they had progressed only a few hundred yards when Abner heard the kahunas walking behind them, and he said, I don't want to argue with them anymore. But when Kelolo turned to tell the kahunas so, he saw nothing. There were no kahunas. There were no walking men. There was only an ominous echo under the scudding clouds, and suddenly Kelolo grabbed Abner in a vice of death and muttered in horror, It is the night marchers. Oh God, we are lost. And before Abner could protest, Kelolo had caught him about the waist and had swept him precipitately over a hedge and thrown him into a ditch where foul water drenched him. When he tried to rise, Kelolo's mighty arm pinned him to the wet earth, and he could feel that the huge Ali'i was trembling in terror. What is it? Abner sputtered. But Kelolo's giant hand clasped his mouth, accidentally forcing grass and mud into his lips. It is the night marchers, Kelolo whispered, his lips quivering in horror. Who are they? Abner whispered back, pulling Kelolo's hand from his mouth. The great Ali'i of the past, Kelolo trembled. I am afraid they are coming for me. Ridiculous, Abner grunted, trying to break free. But his captor held him pinioned in the ditch, and he could feel the awful tenseness of the big man's muscles. Kelolo was terrified. Why are they coming for you? Abner whispered. No one knows, Kelolo replied, his teeth chattering. Perhaps because I gave the land of Kane for your church. With the greatest circumspection, he lifted his huge head until it was even with the top of the hedge, looked for a moment up the dark path, and shuddered. They are marching toward us, he gasped. O Makuahale, pray to your God for me. Pray, pray. Kelolo, Abner grunted, smothered by the pressure on his chest. There is nothing out there. When Ali'i die, they remain dead. They are marching, Kalolo whispered. And in the silence of the night, with only wind rustling through dead palm leaves, there was indeed a sound of feet. I can see them coming past the church, Kalolo reported. They carry torches and feathered staves. They wear their golden robes and feather helmets. Makuahale, they are coming for me. The giant Ali'i pressed himself into the ditch, hiding Abner beneath his ample form, and the missionary could hear the man praying, O Pele, save me now. I am your child, Kalolo, and I do not want to die tonight. The sound grew louder, and Kalolo engaged in violent actions, almost smothering Abner, who mumbled, What are you doing? Undressing, Kalolo grunted. You cannot speak to the gods with clothes on. When he was completely naked, he resumed praying in an agitated voice. But suddenly, he grew calm, and Abner heard him say, The little man I am hiding is Makuahale. He is a good man, and he brings learning to my people. He doesn't know enough to throw off his clothes, so please excuse him. There was a long silence, after which Kalolo said, I know the little man preaches against you, woman of whiteness, but even so he is a good man. There was another protracted silence, and then the sound of imminent feet. And Kalolo trembled as if a great wind tormented him, and then he spoke, Thank you, Pele, for having told the marchers I am your child. The wind subsided. Only fitful sounds came from the topmost crowns of the coconut palms, and there was no echo of marching feet. It could have been the kahunas going home, Abner thought. It could have been a group of dogs, or wind along the dusty footpath. Now there was no sound. The low, scudding clouds were gone, and the stars shone. What was it? Abner asked, as he wiped the mud from his mouth. They were marching to take me away, Kalolo explained. Whom were you speaking to? Abner inquired, spitting the gravel from his teeth. Pele, didn't you hear her tell the marchers that we were her children? Abner did not reply. He brushed the sand from his clothes and wondered how he would get the muddy portions of his clothing cleaned. And he was brushing his knees when Kalolo grabbed him and spun him around, demanding, You did hear Pele, didn't you, when she protected you? Did she mention my name? Abner asked quietly. You heard her, Kalolo cried. Makuahale, it is a very good sign when Pele protects a man. It means... But his joy at having been saved from the revengeful night marchers was so great that he could not express his gratitude, either for her aid in saving him or for her unprecedented benevolence in protecting the little missionary. You are my brother, Kalolo said passionately. Now you see that it would have been foolish for me to have torn down my platform to the gods. Suppose Pele had not come to help us tonight. Did you see the night marchers? Abner pressed. I saw them, Kalolo replied. Did you see Pele? The missionary continued. I often see her, Kalolo assured him. Then, in a burst of passion, he caught Abner by the hands and pleaded, It is for these reasons, Makuahale, that I beg you not to keep the door where it is. That door, Abner began. But he did not bother to finish his sentence. And when he reached home and Jerusha cried, Abner, what have you been doing? He replied simply, It was dark, and I fell in a ditch. And the door was built where he intended. Then, when it seemed as if the mission were gaining control of Lahaina, the whaler John Goodpasture out of New Bedford put in with a record tonnage of oil from the recently discovered off-Japan whaling grounds, and Jerusha's school for girls was suddenly interrupted by the excited cry from the road, Kenamoku, too many sailors inside boat, come right away here. Since the John Goodpasture was well and favorably known in Lahaina from previous visits, the intelligence created much excitement, especially among the four daughters of Pupale, who spent the next few minutes darting significant glances at one another. Finally, they rose as a team and marched out of class. When Jerusha tried to stop them, the oldest girl explained that their youngest sister felt ill. "Poor Iliki head all come sore," and amid loud giggles they disappeared. At first, Jerusha did not appreciate what had happened. But later, when one of her students blurted out, "Kapena aloha Iliki, she swim ship, see Kapena," it became obvious that the mission's moral teaching had been outraged, and Jerusha dismissed class. Wrapping a light shawl about her shoulders and placing her poke bonnet firmly on her brown locks, she marched down to the waterfront in time to see the four girls, largely naked, climbing eagerly aboard the John Goodpasture, where sailors who had known them before greeted them with cheers. Running up to an elderly American sailor who was scrimshawing a whalebone beside Kamehameha's old brick palace, she cried, "Row me out to that boat." But the sailor continued carving the whalebone and drawled, "Ma'am, it's best if you don't fight the laws of nature." "But Iliki is only a child," Jerusha protested. "First law of the sea, ma'am. If they're big enough, they're old enough." And he looked out into the channel, where the girls' pleased squeals filled the air. Appalled by this indifference, Jerusha ran over to an old Hawaiian woman who sat on a rock guarding the four mission dresses which the girls had discarded. "Auntie Mele," Jerusha pleaded, "how can we get those girls back?" "You stop one time, by-and-by ship go," Auntie Mele assured her. "Vahini come back, same like always." In frustration, Jerusha grabbed at the besmirched mission dresses as if to take them home with her, away from the contaminated waterfront. But Auntie Mele held onto them grimly, saying, "Holly Vahini, by and by Vahini come back, I make ready dress for them." And like the good friend she was, she remained on the rock, holding the girls' apparel until such time as they might need it once more for resumption of their missionary lessons. That night,